One of the things that marks our relationship with money is the passage of time. Think about that first job where you were maybe underpaid, or something painful like a debt. Is it in the past now? Does it hang over your future? Or looking ahead, where you want yourself to be in 20 years? This week, I've been thinking about money and time. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. We know from jobs numbers that came out on Friday that wages in the U.S. have increased the most since 2009. That's great news, and our economy is in a very different place now than it was then. You'll hear thoughts about time throughout our show this week. Listeners, financial goals, new kinds of businesses that maybe haven't figured out how to profit, and even what musician Nico Case has learned after a 20-year career. Come tell us your stories about money and time on our website, marketplaceweekend.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Back to that thread about money and time. Every week, we're having conversations about money that aim to get at something a little deeper, how you order your priorities, or what's really important to you. I'm often awed by how generous people are with their stories. This week, we asked what financial goal you want to meet by this time next year. One person on our Facebook page says he wants to finally land a job after 700 applications. Another is trying to get a small business off the ground. Larry Ditburner in Minnesota is 70 and in the middle of whittling down about $18,000 in debt that used to hang over him.
We want to be free of credit card debt, which we expect will happen when we get our taxes back, that we will use a majority of the money we get back for that.
So let me ask you then, when you think about this as a goal, what are the steps to get there?
Well, you know, we live pretty frugally now. My wife was forced to retire because of her health about 3 years ago. That cut our family income in half, which was really serious. So we just live really tight. We feel we live really well, but we save substantial amounts of money every month. We're down to one car. I ride the bus. In the wintertime, it's free because I'm a veteran of Vietnam. I seldom eat out when I go to work. Renee makes my lunch. So we're really pulling back, and we're happy. We're fine the way we live.
You teach school, so I am curious, when you think about the idea of goals, and I gather you teach little kids, do you kind of put that as a principle that they should learn when they're young? And how important are goals in your life?
Right. Well, part of my training as a teacher is I took Montessori training. And Montessori pedagogy is all about helping children to be their best selves and to realize their full potential. So in the school that I work at, which is a private Montessori school in Minneapolis, that's part of the deal is to help children to set goals and to commit to goals.
It sounds like that's translated into your relationship with money.
You for sure. And actually my wife has helped a lot with this because I tend to spend from the heart and she's very rational. So she it's good that she's in charge of the money because she makes those kinds of decisions and we talk about it and then we go from there.
Larry Ditburner, thank you so much for reaching out.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I love your show. I learn a lot from it. So I appreciate it.
At the other end of the age spectrum, 23-year-old Hannah Perlman is in L.A. She knows one of our producers and got in touch with this pretty basic goal.
Just to afford my life. I just want to be able to pay my rent and buy myself groceries and pay for my gas.
So that's a pretty basic one, but a pretty good one. What are you doing right now to make money?
Right now, I work as a sales associate, and I'm also a nanny, so I'm working two jobs right now.
And then your real ambition, I guess, is to be an actor. So how do you pursue that?
Well, for acting, it's difficult financially just because I'm spending a lot of money, I think, to get myself where I want to be. So I'm taking classes, which are definitely not not cheap, and, you know, buying headshots and resumes and driving myself to auditions and then paying for parking. And so it's definitely an investment, but it's worth it. It's just a matter of figuring out how to manage my money so that I can make it work.
And you're pretty young. You're 23, so I'm curious whether the idea of setting goals, like, is that something that plays a role in your life in general, or is this new to you?
I think I definitely set goals for myself. I try to not set them too high because there's just no knowing where I'll be in 10 years. And so I think I can really reach a bigger goal if I just take it 1 year at a time because I'm so young.
Hannah Perlman, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Next week, we're taking a page from what Larry Ditburner told us and thinking about money lessons. What do you teach your kids about money? Maybe your parents, the people you love. Tell us the most important lesson you want to pass on about money. Go to MarketplaceWeekend.org, our Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND, or you can call us at 1-800-648-5114. Now we're going to stick with that time theme and make a couple people go on the record with topics in the news that they are long for a long period of time or short, positive or negative, much in the way that stock pickers bet on different equities. And this week, to play the long short game, we've got Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson and Tanvi Misra from CityLab at The Atlantic. Welcome.
Hi.
Hey, Lizzie.
I want to start out with you, Tanvi. What are you long looking into the sort of upcoming news cycle, I guess?
Recently, Paul Ryan took office and he immediately declared that he would not be working with President Obama on immigration. So I think that that means that immigration is going to be kind of even more important as a talking point for candidates in the coming months. And what I'm particularly excited to see and I'm hoping and kind of betting on is that skilled immigration, you know, there's a little bit more focus on that. H-1B skilled worker visas, for example.
Yeah, so we're talking about those sort of the high-skilled visas.
Right, right. Those are the high-skilled visas. There's been a cap on those visas for a while that's in need of an update. And Congress has been talking about that for a while, but, you know, there's nothing that's been done. And I'm hoping that that's one of the issues that's addressed in the next few months.
So it's sort of, I guess we should say, an optimistic long in your case, that these things get more attention in the 2016. Tracy, how about you? You have what's your long for us?
I am long the possibility of Google answering my emails for me. This week, Google announced a service that they're calling Smart Reply, and it's going to suggest up to 3 responses to emails that you get. I am long this idea.
So they're just canned? Like they can be in there?
Well, Google's, yeah, exactly. And you'll be able to choose which one. It's Google says it uses machine learning to recognize the emails that need responses and generate natural language responses on the fly. I would be very pro this if it worked. I'm sort of a little skeptical that it would work in the way that they want it to. If it does, I just need all of the help that I can get
cleaning
with my email.
Yeah.
And like, I will surrender that to Google so happily if they can help somehow with my crazy out of control inbox.
I could use that. You know, there are 2 kinds of people, the inbox zero kind of person. I'm definitely the opposite of that. So any help I could get, I could use.
Tanvi, your short actually comes from the world of tech. Can you give it to us?
Yeah, I hate the new Twitter hearts. I hate them. I do not heart them. I just think that I don't know why they had to change the faves. That was a unique feature.
These are the things that have replaced the favorite star.
Yes. And I don't really understand why, because I think the faves were pretty easy to understand. And I think hearts are a pretty strong affirmation. I'm, you know, like, I'm just not ready for that kind of commitment, I think, when I'm hearting things. I don't know. I'm just not there yet.
I think this is the Facebookization, though, of Twitter, whether intentional or not. The like model has worked for Facebook, and you know, maybe we're all just skeptical journalists who don't like the idea of liking things. But the rest of the world...
We don't want to weigh in pro or con.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
Isn't Facebook even, aren't they creating a dislike button? Haven't they sort of heard the message that you don't want to thumbs up a lot of things? You just want to kind of register something about it?
I have seen this.
Yeah.
That's the response I need in my automated Google email. I recognize that you sent me an email. That's all I want. Tracy, what are you short?
I am short meal delivery services, or more specifically, people talking about their meal delivery services. So this week we learned that Mark Bittman, who used to be at the New York Times, he was this very popular foodie columnist, that he is now with a meal delivery service called Purple Carrot. I just feel like I cannot go anywhere these days without having some really boring conversation where somebody's like, oh, have you heard of Blue Apron, which is another one of these services, Plated, also another one, HelloFresh, another one. There's a whole slew of them, and people are really into it, and I am really not into talking about it.
I do wonder in terms of like, in terms of how these things exist and how they grow, there's a whole lot of them, and I feel like they're all after the same market. It's like a busy, upscale person who maybe lives in an urban area. I mean, how many people who live in my neighborhood in Brooklyn are they really trying to go after? Like, at a certain point, isn't that kind of boring? Don't you max out?
They have, I think, maxed out my entire friend group, because based on the number of people that are like constantly like, oh, have you tried this yet? And oh, the pistachio crusted blah, blah, blah. It's just not like, fine if you do it. I just don't want to hear about it anymore. But yeah, I think it is probably a limited audience. So we'll see how many of these, you know, can sustain themselves.
Tracy Samuelson, Tanvi Misra, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Just ahead on Marketplace Weekend, you've been telling us about the big money stories happening in your neighborhood. And in this week's Local Money, we visit a neighborhood in Queens. Plus, we go to China. That's coming up on Marketplace Weekend. Our news stories are often dominated by numbers, and here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day on marketplace.org. Here are producers Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner with the news. Yep, by the numbers. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
15 to 99.
That's how many dollars Taser International charges per month for police departments to use its cloud storage service.
The company's mostly known for stun guns.
But its growing body cam business means police have tons of data they need to save somewhere.
8.
That's how many millions of turkeys were taken out by bird flu this spring.
The epidemic caused turkey prices to spike 30%.
Analysts say there should still be enough birds for everyone cooking on Thanksgiving Day, but food banks might have a harder time.
74.
That's a portion of Ben Carson's campaign contributions that have come from small donations.
But that's not the highest number among presidential candidates. Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders leads the way with 88% from small donations.
And Sanders could make those dollars stretch further. He's fundraising mostly online, whereas the Carson campaign is relying on expensive mailers.
Is the oh-so-addictive sound of the mobile game Candy Crush. And if you haven't played it, I'm willing to guarantee someone in your life has. That sound is very lucrative, basically worth $5.9 billion. That's how much Activision Blizzard announced they'd pay for King Digital Entertainment this week. King is the company that makes Candy Crush. But here's the puzzle about gaming companies. No one really knows how they keep making money going forward. To talk about that, we've got Joshua Brustein from Bloomberg Business. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
When I think about the amount of money involved here, $5.9 billion, that seems like an awful lot. Can you put that in perspective for me in terms of this industry?
Well, King is sort of seen as the big mobile game company. So, you know, $5.9 billion is probably one of the, you know, most valuable of the mobile games companies. So it's a lot of money, and especially considering that almost no one who plays these games spends any money at all doing so.
Yeah, explain that part to me, because that's the freemium model. And I'm going to be totally honest here. I don't feel like I entirely understand how that business model works.
Yeah, this is the business model that most mobile games use. And you can download the game for free. You can play it for free. But if you want to progress faster or get certain special things within the game, then you can pay. Almost nobody does, like less than 10%. But those who do, some of them spend a lot. And it turns out that when you have, you know, 475 million people playing these games, a couple, you know, a small percentage of that paying a lot turns into a pretty good business.
When you talk to people in this industry that you cover, I mean, why does Activision or another company like that think, okay, this is such a good bet that is going to pay off down the road if just a tiny segment of players are actually, you know, paying for stuff?
Yeah, there's essentially kind of two different halves of the video game industry, and they don't overlap much or even understand one another that much. So you have the Activisions. They make these big games that you spend $60 for. That's kind of the traditional model. And then there's these mobile games, which, as you said, you don't spend anything for at first. They tend to attract a much different crowd. And that's kind of king. And Activision is trying to understand that second model and trying to figure out how can we get into this. And since these guys have been one of the leaders here, you know, let's bring them on.
The last time I had you on the show, we were talking about this a little bit. And one of the questions that I was curious about is, who plays a handheld game? Who plays a console game? And how different are these audiences?
I think that's going to be one of the really interesting things here, because when you look at, you know, the industry research that's been done here, basically young men play console games and older women play smartphone games.
Yes, I mean, this is what my unofficial research during my commutes tells me.
Yes, exactly. This is good Subway, good Subway research, at least for the latter part. Lots of people with phones.
Yes.
Not as many with consoles.
True.
But so it's going to be interesting to see what now that Activision has this enormous group of users who most of them probably aren't playing kind of the core Activision games. How are they going to appeal to them in a way that King Digital wasn't doing already?
When you talk to developers or executives who are trying to understand how this industry moves forward, it feels like a lot of this is sort of stabbing around in the dark. Am I crazy, or do people not quite know what the next thing is yet?
Oh, no, I think that's absolutely right. I think that both, you know, everybody's kind of scared, which is funny because the mobile games, at least at this point, like King is very profitable and, you know, has been for a while. But it's scared that it's not going to hit on the next game. It's clear that the market there is changing very fast. It hasn't been around for very long. And no one kind of knows how to be a stable mobile game developer. That there never has been one. The game industry's only been around for a couple of years. And then you have like kind of the console Call of Duty types. They're scared that fewer people are going to play those games over the long run. That there's not going to be a need for, you know, a separated like a separate game industry that happens in that way. And so they're trying to make sure that they can future-proof themselves by maybe having games that, you know, move across from console to mobile. You hear that sometimes, although I don't think that anyone's really proven that yet. So I think there's a lot of experimentation going on, a lot of spaghetti being thrown at a wall.
Joshua Brustein is a writer for Bloomberg Business. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
At the top of our show, you hear me say the phrase, where the economy collides with real life. This next story is a perfect example. China's economy, which we talk about a lot, is in the middle of slowing down, shifting from a production economy to a consumer one. But if you live there now and make things, your real life is likely quite painful. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has the story of massive layoffs in one city where employment depends almost entirely on coal mining. And 100,000 people are losing their jobs. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Lizzie.
You really had this moment where you got to see sort of China's economic slowdown and the human effects of that up close. Tell me about this coal mining town that you visited.
Yeah, this place is called Qitaihe, and it's a small city by Chinese standards. It's around 1 million people, so obviously very big by U.S. standards. But it's just miles away from China's northeastern border with Russia. And this region has traditionally been known for its agriculture, its mines, and its steel mills. So it had its heyday in the early communist years of Mao, when these industries were the backbone of the party. But that's not the case anymore, you know. So this area has the worst GDP growth in China. And, of course, Qitaihe is doing very badly. It's a bleak city surrounded by coal mines, many of which are run by a single state-owned mining company called Longmei, which just had this huge layoff of 100,000 workers, just like that. And that's nearly half its entire workforce. And many of these workers are in the mines of Qitaihe. I spoke to their families, and all of them blamed this mess on the corruption, not only within the company, but also within the Communist Party itself. And the workers I met who haven't lost their jobs yet are really tough guys. I mean, each day they risk their lives working a mile underground, 10 hours a day, 365 days a year, not a single day off, because, you know, they're scared of losing their jobs. And to make matters worse, they're working for almost nothing. And the company is 2 months behind on paying their salaries. I spoke to one man in this situation, and here's some tape from my conversation with him. Zhang Yong hasn't been paid either. Longmei owes the 52-year-old 2 months of salary, and yet every morning he arrives at the mine and is taken a mile underneath the ground to work a 10-hour shift, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, not a single day of rest. If you ask for a day off, he says, they'll find a worker to replace you. There are plenty of them now. Zhang lives inside an abandoned church. He's a caretaker here when he isn't in the mine.
Every Sunday, this church used to be full. There wasn't a place to sit. Now everyone's moved away.
This neighborhood is deemed uninhabitable. A coal mine lies just beneath the surface of the earth, and it's slowly swallowing the church. The altar has sunken below the back row of pews, and Zhang has nailed a portrait of Jesus atop a wide crack that snakes across the wall like a bolt of lightning. His world is caving in.
Once coal goes bust, Qitaihe's economy won't survive. After the mine shut down, many of us will be forced to move inside the wall.
People up here say inside the wall to refer to the populated part of China that lies south of the Great Wall. Zhangstown is in a region known as Manchuria. It's north of the wall, a place the Chinese used to consider remote, barren, and inhabited by savages. Pretty soon, says Zhang, hordes of miners with no jobs and no education will find their way south to the wealthier cities of Beijing, Shanghai, and beyond. They'll look for work, he says, and if they don't find it, they'll look for trouble.
Rob, that line, they'll look for trouble, has sort of a duality with you, because we could say you made some friends who thought you were trouble of a sort when you were reporting there. Can you tell me what that was about? Because clearly they didn't like you kind of exposing what was happening there.
Yeah, and you know, part of this was, you know, because the story involved a state company, I thought it was fair to pay the local government a call after I was through interviewing the miners and their families. And so I did that. And the local government official in charge of these matters immediately came to my hotel with two police officers, and he interrogated me about why I was there, who I planned to talk to. And, you know, I simply asked him, you know, may I interview anyone in your office? And he refused. And instead, he told me I couldn't speak to anyone at the coal mines, you know, not really knowing that I'd already done so. You know, as a foreign journalist in China, I do have the right to interview people if I get their prior consent. And I reminded him of that rule, but he continued to threaten me. And it was clear that I wasn't going to take any more orders from him. He appointed two police officers to follow me around for the rest of the trip. You know, and in many cases, I felt kind of sorry for these guys. I mean, they had to sleep in the freezing parking lot of my hotel, and they followed me to the airport the next morning. You know, this type of treatment of foreign journalists, which was more common in the 1980s and 90s in China and then sort of died down in the 2000s, is becoming common again, you know, as China's economy begins to slow down and as President Xi Jinping cracks down on corruption. You know, a lot of these local officials like this guy who are scared of their own job security get very nervous whenever a journalist shows up in town.
Rob, so many of these people you spoke with, this is the only job they've had and life they've known. What happens when all of this stuff goes away? Do they have any other options?
No, and I think you can sort of read the desperation in their voices, you know, especially of the wives of these miners. I mean, they have no other options, really, because this is all they know. They're not educated very well, and this is all they've done for many, many years. You know, as China's economy turns towards a more service-oriented model, those jobs pay less, and, you know, I think for them, it's you know, they may see it as a step down, maybe not, but it's still not easy for them, you know, financially.
Rob Schmitz, our China Bureau Chief from Shanghai. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
When the people who run crowded cities think about how to deal with housing in the future, one of the biggest challenges is space, especially if we're talking about a place where it's expensive to build. New York, where our show is based, is definitely that. And as part of our Local Money project, where we take your suggestions for stories, listeners wrote us about a big potential building project in New York, where Mayor Bill de Blasio wants to build affordable housing in what is now a rail yard. So we went to check it out with Jean Marie Evely, who covers the neighborhood for the website DNA Info. She took me to the giant gray rail yard that covers about 180 acres.
So we're standing just outside the Sunnyside Rail Yards, which is a almost 200-acre rail yard in western Queens. It is used by both Amtrak and the MTA as sort of a maintenance, railroad storage yard, that sort of thing.
I mean, I'm looking at the stuff in front of us. We've got something with a smokestack, some old reeds, a lot of old cars. This is not what I would describe as the world's most beautiful place.
Yeah, it's a very industrial area, definitely. It's been obviously a lot of construction happening around the rail yards in recent years, but the rail yards themselves are sort of still just what they were built for.
And what does Mayor Bill de Blasio want to do here?
He proposed and first mentioned this during his State of the City address in February, building a large affordable housing complex on top of the rail yards here. He wants to build just over 11,000 affordable units, and that would house, he said, up to something like 30,000 New Yorkers. It would be a big part of his plans for increasing the number of affordable housing in the city.
I mean, I'm looking just at the physical nature of this. To build apartments on top of this, what would you have to do?
So they would actually be building a platform over the rail yards, which would remain active, and then build the housing on top of that. And so, yeah, it's a really big rail yard. It would be pretty much take a lot of planning and a lot of engineering to put this into place. But it's similar to projects that have been done and are underway already at, like, Atlantic Yards in Brooklyn, Hudson Yards on the west side. So it has been done before, but it's definitely going to take a lot of work.
And a lot of, I would assume, money.
Yes, definitely a lot of money. A price tag, a specific price tag hasn't been talked about yet, but all the housing experts I've spoken to say, yes, it would be a very, very costly endeavor.
How do people in the community feel about this?
Yeah, so there has been some pushback from the local community. A lot of elected officials and residents here are wary of any kind of huge increase in development in the area just because there is so much already going on in Western Queens, especially here in Long Island City. If you look around, it's like there's a construction site on pretty much every block. And people are really worried about what a project of that size would do to the neighborhood's infrastructure. Things like schools, the local subways, which people feel are already very strained. Schools are overcrowded. Subways, if you ever ride the 7, it's usually pretty packed. There's a lot of worry about how that many new people would sort of impact that.
What happens next or now?
So this is all very, very early. He basically mentioned this to sort of get the conversation going. The city did issue a request for proposals for a feasibility study to take a look at sort of what it would even take to make this happen and whether or not it's even possible. They did that RFP, I think, in February, and that study itself would be a year long. So it's going to be another probably year or two before we see any kind of more detailed things emerge about this. So it could be a really long time before any of this starts to happen. Some planning experts I spoke to said like a decade or more.
We're out here in part because when you think about where people live in New York, writ broadly, New York is a big and crowded place. And I guess the one thing this area has going for it is space.
Absolutely. Sunnyside Yards, there's been talk about developing the yards for years now because it is sort of one of the last very large parcels of undeveloped land. There isn't a lot of space to build on in New York anymore. This is one of the few places that can still happen. And I think it's a big opportunity, and the de Blasio administration sees it as a big opportunity to make a dent in the affordable housing crisis here.
Jean Marie Eveli, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We want to tell your community's big money stories, so let us know what they are. Go to our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and click on Local Money. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Maybe you've heard of the Proust questionnaire. It's a set of questions about values and wishes, often incorrectly attributed to French writer Marcel Proust. He actually answered it, not wrote it. We made a similar one about money, because what we spend and why is awfully revealing. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and this weekend, we've got musician Nico Case.
Hi, my name is Nico Case, and I'm an American musician, and I currently reside in Vermont.
When did you realize music could be a career?
I realized music could be an actual paying career in the funny way that I didn't have time to show up for either of my two jobs anymore because I was on tour all the time. So it was more like, well, this one's kind of paying the bills, so maybe ride this dolphin into the sunset or until the dolphin kicks you off. There are still moments I think I made the wrong decision. It's like, oh, I'm a husbandless troll. There's nobody here but me on my windy, snowy rock that I'm going to shovel by myself for the next 6 hours. But then I go, nah, I'm Jeremiah Johnson, man. Wanted for murder. Living on my own. Kicking it with bears. You know, it's kind of romantic.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you a presidential election.
In a next life, what would your career be?
In my next life, I would kind of like to devote all of my time to farming. Unfortunately, I have to leave a lot because I'm a musician, as I said, and there's a lot of touring. Because despite what people think, that's how we make our money is touring, not from selling records. So we're out there like little mules in the Borax mule train. Muling is fine, but I'd like to, you know, mix my muling up a little bit.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
I don't know if it's hard or so much just a savage truth, is that there is pretty much zero glamour involved in being a touring musician. There's a lot of truck stop toilets that are exactly the same truck stop toilets that you used when you first started touring. Which I'm not complaining about, you know, a truck stop toilet is still a toilet, but there's no hot tubs, there's no, I don't know, custom-made fancy tour buses with steam rooms on them, unless you're at a certain level, which most of us aren't.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
When I first started making a little bit of money, meaning having cash in my hand that I wasn't used to, ever in the history of my life, because I grew up incredibly poor, I started buying clothes that would look nice on stage, dresses that were kind of nicer and well-made, and then about 10 years later, I realized I absolutely hate wearing dresses. Why did I buy those? And there's this weird psychology with money that happens that you don't realize, which is you don't necessarily do the right thing. You do what you think you're supposed to do with it. And you know, to me, having $3,000 over the course of a month was just unheard of. I felt like an absolute billionaire. And I just realized I had never been taught anything about money, and it's just a learn as you go. And it's kind of a boo-hoo, yeah, whatever lady situation, but the point is that money has a bizarre psychology that will really mess with you. It's a wild horse of a jerk.
Nico Case's new vinyl box set, Truck Driver Gladiator Mule, is out November 13th.
Baby, come out. meet you in the street.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. And normally this is the part where I say hello, Ben, but this week we're doing something a little bit different. So, hi.
Hi, Lizzie.
What's going on? You're launching a new podcast, Codebreaker. And I want to start with the question you start with. Is it evil? What in the world does that mean, man?
Okay, so on Codebreaker, we're trying to sort of decipher our complicated feelings about technology. Lizzie, you know, you and I, as we've experienced doing our tech IRL segments together, sometimes it can be good, sometimes it can be bad. And we wanted to do some deep dives on this and how really technology is changing us and changing the way that we behave. And sometimes there's positive outcomes, sometimes negative. The first season looks at instances on both sides and through that tries to get at a deeper understanding of one kind of technology in every episode.
And the first episode tackles email.
Yes. Email is a really interesting thing because it's totally changed the way we work, the way we conduct business, the way we communicate, obviously. But not all of those changes are good changes, Lizzie. One of the people I talked to was Dr. Ian Paul. He's at the Penn State Hershey Children's Hospital, and he was really mad about email.
Well, I was very frustrated about it as a busy pediatrician, getting lots of emails that are not related to my direct job responsibilities has been a source of frustration for many years.
And Dr. Paul did this kind of really interesting accounting study. It's unofficial, not scientific, but very detailed. And he found evidence of what he says is millions of dollars in cost to his institution related to unnecessary time spent reading and sending email.
That sounds familiar.
That relates. We also talked to an informatics professor. She tells us about how she's found over time, she studied email a lot, and she's found that sending email, Lizzie, feels really good, but getting it doesn't feel so good, which is this terrible, vicious cycle.
It can actually be really fun to be like, please deal with this. Send.
Exactly. You're like adding to someone's to-do list, right?
But there are some good stories in this episode about email. Tell me about those.
I talked to a woman. Her name is Adele Garrity. She's originally from the state of New York. She was living upstate. And she actually sent this email way back in 2001, so we're talking AOL here, to the wrong email address.
I'd begun writing a newspaper column, a comedy satire column, that covered about a tri-county area in the Hudson Valley.
She read a piece in her local newspaper by another author that she liked, and there was an email address at the end.
I followed up with a little blurb that was at the bottom of her column, which said that she produced a literary magazine and was looking for local writers to submit. So I followed the email address, which was author54.
That's author54@AOL.com.
And sent in a request to know what her submission guidelines were. And the very next day, I got a response. The response was rather strange, though. It said, Dear Adele, I'm not the party you're seeking. Yours is the third email of this type I've received this week, and I have no clue if someone's using my email address illegally. It was a typo. Instead of author 54, it should have been author 45.
Honest mistake. But now she was talking to this guy, Phil, and Phil wasn't going away.
He was so impressed, or I should say grateful, that I'd sent him that email and explained things, that that evening he instant messaged me. It kind of shook me because I really didn't talk to strangers online. I didn't go in chat rooms or anything like that. So when this little box popped up on the screen, I almost jumped off my seat. I said, who's this?
So they started chatting over America Online's instant messenger service.
We began to talk. And about 20 minutes into the chat, he suddenly said to me, well, you know, you're up awfully late, aren't you? And I thought, no. I looked at my watch and I said, typed back, no, it's only 7:45. And then I thought a minute, there was silence, and I said, where are you? And he said, I'm in Sheffield. That's in England. I said, well, yes, I know. And he said, well, where are you? And I said, upstate New York is, oh my God, you're a Yank. The next day, there was a letter from him. My address at the time was Deep Ocean Fish 2. And there was this email for me the next day that said, hello, fishy. And I thought, oh, this is funny. And I read it, and he was very welcoming, wanted to chat again. And I would say within a month, we were meeting every day.
But did it feel different?
It definitely felt different. At first, it felt very strange. But the strangeness wasn't what was happening to me. It was how could it be happening to me? Because people are used to being tactile. You see someone, you have a visual impression, and not just from a photo. But this was actually falling in love with someone from the inside out. There were no diversions. It was simply him and me and who we were inside.
A totally accidental relationship between people who would never have met in real life. And for some weird reason, they kept talking every day. They started this whole intimate relationship almost exclusively on email. You know the next big move, right?
There was only one brief moment of cold feet before I took the plane. He wanted to meet me, but he was afraid. I was in a way too, but I was more afraid that he wouldn't like me after we got together. We both sat down. We went offline for a while and cleared the air, got back on, talked it through and said, we both got cold feet. That's all it is. This is silly. We've known each other for a year now. The time is right to just put the last piece of the puzzle together.
All right. But what do you tell your friends?
We were hearing a lot of horror stories about people who met online. And I was reluctant to tell some of my friends about this because they thought, oh, horror, you know, no. When I did open up to my children and my in-laws, my brother and his wife, I got reactions like, oh, my God, he could be an axe murderer, or you're imagining this. It's an online relationship. It's not real. I was certain that I didn't really care if when I saw him, he resembled Quasimodo. I was already in love with him.
Did he look like Quasimodo?
Nah, not at all. He kind of tapped me on the shoulder when he first saw me and said, my God, you're real.
This was a really serendipitous digital moment that changed your life.
It did. It changed both our lives, really, in so many ways. And not just us, but our children and our children's children.
But it's also, I mean, it could have never happened in the first place. It's two numbers. That's the difference in your life, is two numbers.
It's a miracle. And when I think of it, an email address, that's all it was. It gave me my husband and my future. And I'm very grateful for that.
What do you say, Lizzie? Touches your heart or is it creepy?
You can see me that I had like my hands over my eyes listening to part of this, having very physical reactions, because there are so many versions of a story like this that go very badly.
Yes.
But this also, you're talking about 2001, which was a very different era.
Totally.
I was pretty floored by that. I want to listen to the rest of it. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, our guide to tech in real life. And right now, what is evil or not? With this new podcast, Codebreaker. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
The first episode of Codebreaker, a collaboration with the website Tech Insider, comes out November 11th. Subscribe now in iTunes. If you want a story of not great numbers, then take a look at Chipotle recently. Its third quarter earnings were not so hot, and a graph of its stock over the past week or so looks like a playground slide. The restaurant chain is dealing with an E. coli outbreak, and even beyond that, big questions about its supply chain. Remember, high-quality ingredients have always been a part of its sales pitch. Roberto Ferdman covers food and economics for The Washington Post and says, yeah, this is not great for Chipotle.
There are several restaurants that we know are tied to the E. coli outbreak. They've hired food safety experts to assess how well they sanitize their restaurants and how well they are at dealing with their food in order to avoid these sorts of things, because clearly there's a problem. Chipotle's sales pitch is similar to other restaurants in that it serves food and that it does it quickly, but it's different from other restaurants in the sense that its sales pitch revolves around a mission, around something about its food that is specific to Chipotle. In fact, if you go on its website, you'll find that they talk about things like sustainability. They talk about things like animal welfare. They talk about things like fresh food and locally sourced foods. And they've been really good about making true on these promises.
Yeah, so, I mean, this raises the question of like, okay, so if the thing that is an integral part of how you sell yourself is, well, everything is, what's the word, ethically sourced or whatever, how do you make that huge? How do you scale that up?
So last year, they found that one of what was probably their largest pork supplier wasn't adhering to their standards. They stopped serving pork, carnitas, as people probably know it, who go to Chipotle and order it, at 600 restaurants around the country. That's a lot of restaurants. And in the aftermath, they had to report sales that were dissatisfying to investors. In fact, comparable sales, which are sales at stores that have been open for a year, it's a good measure of how people feel about your brand and whether they're going into your stores, fell. That's very uncommon for Chipotle. What that shows you is that they made a decision to defend their mission that did harm to their business. And this is probably going to continue to happen going forward. Pork is a perfect example. There's a very, very small percentage of pork that's produced in this country is raised outside of gestation crates. If Chipotle wants to become huge, which I'm sure it does, or huger, it's going to have to either change that, which is not easy, or give in to that.
One of the things that you have written about is other companies that are changing the way that they source their food products too. Is that because of Chipotle or is that demand from people around the country or what?
I think it has to do more with a general wave. Chipotle's popularity is emblematic of that wave. The fact that we want to go eat at Chipotle or that people do is partly because they feel better about what they're paying for, what they're buying into. I mean, McDonald's recently announced that in the next 10 years, they're going to use only cage-free eggs. Starbucks recently announced that they're going to do it in 5 years. Dunkin' Donuts has announced this in the past. These things are really important for the food system. McDonald's is the largest buyer of eggs in this country.
Wow.
What that means is that suddenly egg suppliers, egg producers, are going to have to change the way in which they raise their eggs. What that means for someone like Chipotle, who doesn't sell eggs but for other products, it would mean that they have a much easier way to supply the business that they want to create or they want to continue supplying.
The one outlier in all of this, though?
Is Yum Brands, specifically Taco Bell.
Why?
So let's be fair, okay? I'm sure that part of the decision that these other companies made had to do with their belief in values, belief in animal welfare, but it was also driven by the fact that they believed it would help their bottom line.
Absolutely. That's why companies make decisions.
That's exactly right. Let's not pretend. Taco Bell doesn't sell the same thing that Chipotle sells. I mean, it sells food, but it kind of revolves more around kitsch. Taco Bell probably doesn't think that it needs to change its sourcing because its customers don't buy it because its food is ethically sourced or sustainable.
It's also cheap.
It's also cheap. And, you know, if we contrast that against, say, McDonald's has moved upscale a bit, not very successfully. So one wonders whether Taco Bell has actually made the right business decision. And in fact, when you look at Yum Brands, the parent company, which is struggling a lot these days, largely because of how they're performing in China, many people have suggested that they spin off Taco Bell because Taco Bell, which does almost all of its business in the U.S., is actually doing just fine.
Roberto Ferdman writes about food and economics for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, tell us the most important lesson you're passing on about money. Visit MarketplaceWeekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament, Haley Hirschman, and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, with help this week from Golda Arthur. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.